it can give a true picture of how immune someone is.
This kind of test could be especially helpful for immunocompromised people. If a person's antibody response is reduced or depleted, they may need a specialized and highly specific immunization plan. Monitoring T-cell response could help doctors to individualize the vaccination recommendations.
This test could help to monitor the overall population's immunity, as well as the effectiveness of new and old vaccines, and it could greatly aid in fine-tuning our pandemic response.
Thanks for listening to Noise Filter, your public health podcast.
Be sure to subscribe to the Noise Filter podcast, follow us on social media, and leave us a review letting us know your favorite part of the show.
You can find me, Hope Hickerson, at hopehickerson.com.
And you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at The Dr. Derry. That's D-R-D-E-R-Y.
To see and share our amazing animations and find out more information about us, the show, as well as links to our social media, go to noisefiltershow.com.
We are grateful to our sponsors, including Access Health Louisiana and the End the Epidemic Initiative, who are working to bring equitable health outcomes to everyone they serve. Hope, any last words?
Stay well out there, folks, and continue taking steps to keep yourself and your loved ones healthy. That includes exercise, a good diet, getting adequate sleep, and seeing your healthcare providers regularly.
And protect yourself and others by getting the COVID-19 vaccine and booster, wearing a mask, and social distancing wherever possible. Remember, health is a human right.
Good evening and welcome to TransPositive. Tonight we're going to be talking with Heather about her experience with the medical community, and we'll also be talking about some things in the news regarding trans people. I'm Nicolette and I use AM or they, them pronouns.
My name is Emma. I use she and her pronouns.
My name is Carter and I use they, them.
Jean, do you want to introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm Jean. I'm a infrequent co-host of the show, and I use she, her pronouns.
All right, great. Thank you. So, Carter, why don't you start off with whatever you'd like to tell us about your experiences?
Yeah, I have talked a bit about the different experiences that I've had with medical professionals and differences that I have noticed being disabled and being transgender. And this year has been pretty tough on me. I've gone through a bit of a battle. I had been admitted to the ICU this year. I've had quite a few inpatient stays in the hospital, as well as some procedures, and wanted to just share a bit about my experiences. And when I got sick in February, I ended up in the hospital and doctors didn't believe my symptoms and didn't want to treat me, even though I was having really bad pain. I ended up having antibiotic-resistant bacteria in my body, and I was told to go to the ER to be admitted to the hospital because the only thing that you can do when you're infected with a bacteria that can't be solved with regular antibiotics is to get IV antibiotics. And I was sent home after going to the emergency room because I was told that I could just take an oral medication for this, but I have a condition called gastroparesis, which is a paralyzed stomach. And with gastroparesis, people have a variety of different symptoms, but for me, I can't keep anything down. And so I was unable to keep down the antibiotics and ended up being sent home and having to go back a few days later to then be admitted. But sadly, during that stay, the bug ended up coming back a few weeks later. And I was in the hospital and had some seizures and ended up in the ICU. And I've talked about how paramedics have treated me very unfairly because of my seizures. And when I got out of the ICU, I had a it's a temporary but permanent IV. It's called a PICC line in my arm, and that really sucked because when I had a seizure out of the hospital, paramedics had tried to lift me up. And they had pulled on this line, which could have caused a lot of problems, including another infection. And then in April and May, I got really, really sick because of my stomach. And I was going to my doctors and explaining how I, at that point, could not keep anything down and was throwing up over 40 times a day, and just no food or fluid. I was seeing a dietitian, and my dietitian wanted me to have a feeding tube to get me nutrition because there was just no way that I'd be able to get any nutrition. And I ended up in May having to go back to the emergency room, and I had to go to the emergency room three times before they would admit me to the hospital the first time. And when I was admitted to the hospital the first time, the doctors told me that I wasn't sick enough to need a feeding tube and that it was all in my head, which if you're disabled, you hear that a lot and it really hurts because you know that you're not faking. You know that there's something wrong with you and doctors just aren't believing you. And after some really traumatic experiences for being in the hospital for a week, they discharged me without having any way of sustaining myself. I still wasn't able to eat or drink. I was unable to care for myself because it was so bad. I couldn't transfer to and from my wheelchair without assistance. And then 2 days after being discharged the first time, I ended up back in the emergency room and was readmitted. And during that stay, there was a psychiatrist who had came in, and they had said that I was attention seeking and that I was just looking for procedures because I had a personality disorder. And I do not have a personality disorder, and there's nothing wrong with people who do, but to misdiagnose someone with that can be very harmful because they're not going to be able to get the treatment that they require. And he had put it in that I was also drug seeking, and because I was needing my pain medication that I take outpatient. This psychiatrist told the doctor that I should not be given certain medication and not give me a feeding tube at that time as well. And at that point, I had lost over 40 pounds in 2 months, which is quite significant amount of weight to have lost. And I was having to get electrolyte replacements daily while I was in the hospital. And after a week then, I was also discharged with no way of helping myself, and having to get help outside of the hospital, it was incredibly hard. Because of what happened in the hospital a month later in June, so last month, I ended up being hit by a car, and I was taken to the hospital, and they did not treat my pain. They told me that I could take muscle relaxers, even though I couldn't keep anything down. Paramedics didn't even take me to the hospital. Paramedics told me to go home and take a nap after I was hit by a car in my wheelchair, which a lot of people in wheelchairs are sadly hit by cars. When I had to tell the wheelchair company that I was hit by a car, they were sadly not surprised. And then this month I had to have some other procedures done, and it everything came back to the treatment that I had in May from having these misdiagnoses and being labeled as drug seeking by needing help. And when I was finally able to have a doctor believe me and put in a feeding tube, I had lost over 70 pounds in 4 months. So I just wanted to share my experience with the medical system again, because the medical system just treats disabled people so unfairly.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. And I'm really sorry all that happened to you. I've, I guess, kind of also had similar experiences, especially like with my lupus. When I first started showing symptoms, I went to multiple doctors who, because they couldn't find anything wrong with me, they're just basically like, well, maybe it's just all in your head. Maybe you're just making it up. And I've read an awful lot of reports and articles about how AFAB people in particular, or people who are assigned female at birth, are often just not taken seriously by medical professionals because they see quote unquote women, even though some of us aren't women, as hysterical and attention seeking and exaggerating, overreacting, making stuff up, you know. And it's ridiculous that this misogyny is still so pervasive in our medical system.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was also going to say, I find it very shocking that one of these so-called medical professionals tried to accuse you of having a personality disorder just because you were seeking emergency care treatment. Like, I'm literally diagnosed with a personality disorder, and that diagnosis came after several months of intensive therapy. Like, that's
exactly it's not. And the worst part about this was that psychiatrist saw me for less than 5 minutes. He had came in the room, he had asked me if I needed anything. I told him no, I did not need any help. He asked me 3 or 4 times. I repeated that I did not need any help. I was also in a Zoom waiting room with my therapist, like waiting for my therapist to log on. And it wasn't until he asked me for like the 4th time and asked me if I needed any help with medication. So he had asked me like 6 times total if I needed anything. And by that time I had said, well, I take this medication outpatient. Can I please have this rescue med for inpatient? Because if you know anything about a hospital, it's very stressful and very anxiety provoking. And it's in my medical history, like noted many times, that I don't have a personality disorder. And I definitely have noticed it too, that people assigned female at birth are more likely to be diagnosed with a personality disorder than anything else, like PTSD or complex PTSD, which like this psychiatrist didn't even say which personality disorder it was. He just said personality disorder.
Which is not even a diagnosis. And just, that sounds like a terrible, terrible lack of care and complete lack of consideration. Like, it boggles me that somebody can even call themselves a mental health professional if they're gonna do that.
Yeah, I reported him to the hospital, and the hospital said that there wasn't anything that they could do other than share my concerns and give feedback to the doctor.
Yeah. Carter, this is Jean.
Yes.
And first of all, oh my God, you know, your story is crushing and horrible. Two thoughts crossed my mind as I listened. Number one, I was wishing, imagining that you were sharing your story before a congressional committee. That's pretty, yeah, it's like, I don't know about anybody else here, but you know, I've been watching some congressional hearings lately. And, you know, I was just wishing, it's like, oh my God, you know, they need to be sharing this in front of a congressional committee. And then the second thought that I had is that, and not to take anything away from the horror of your experience, but that so much of what you shared is inherent in the fact that healthcare in this country is a business. It's a business. It has almost nothing to do with healthcare. It's a business. And, you know, I can't say that I've ever experienced anything on the scope of what you shared, Carter, but I myself have been brushed off any number of times. You know, because they've, you know, the healthcare provider only had 7 minutes to spend with me, and you know, no real, so there's no, healthcare does not really exist in this country unless you are wealthy.
Yeah.
It's simple.
It definitely was a shock to me when I was going home from the hospital when I was in a crosswalk, and the driver stopped, and because he had to turn, and so he stopped, and he thought that he could pass me, and that's when he had hit me. And I had just gotten my brand new wheelchair 4 days prior that I had waited over a year to get. And it was ruined. I ended up having a concussion, and I still have significant pain from the crash. And I was flipped over into the intersection. And when paramedics got there, they had no care about me, because all they saw was me being flagged in the 911 system because of my seizures. And instead of caring for me and taking me to the emergency room, they told me to go home and take a nap.
Well, you know, Carter, they probably thought that because they saw your wheelchair that was totaled, and they saw you already laying down on the pavement because you'd gotten knocked over because you got hit by a car. So they probably thought, oh, well, this would be a good time for you to take a nap.
Oh, absolutely. It's, you know, I was so close to home. Why not just finish going home? I couldn't talk. I couldn't communicate in any way. And I ended up with my broken wheelchair having to take myself to the hospital because they wouldn't. And in May, I had done the paperwork to have DNR status, which is do not resuscitate. And then within that, there's a lot of different things that you can select. You can say that you don't want intubation, but you want compressions. You don't want compressions, but you will allow medication. There's different things that you can select when you want DNR status. And I was told that I was too young to be thinking about being DNR, that I would heal totally fine from having CPR. Last year in July, my friend had to perform CPR on me. And that is not something I ever want to happen again. And I think that it is taking charge of your own healthcare and really thinking ahead about what you want and if you want to be a full code or if you want to be DNR, because you never know when an accident might happen. Because I never planned on getting hit by a car. It's my worst nightmare to be hit by a car in a wheelchair, because cars will see me and see me as a challenge because I'm, quote, going too slow, even though I go faster than most people walking.
Carter, this is Jean again. Hun, I'll do my best to pose this in a sensitive way. Obviously, from your story, there are multiple layers of issues that you have to live with. And so my question for you is, upon reflection, to what extent do you feel that your trans identity has complicated the story that you shared with us?
Yes, that is an amazing question. So paramedics, they would misgender me almost every time they saw me. They would purposefully do it after knowing what my gender identity is and what my pronouns are. But when I was in the hospital and even on seeing my normal doctors, they will put in quotations what my gender identity is, or they will use the wrong pronouns and I'll correct them and I'll be like, please, you know, update this language, and they will refuse. So they definitely just don't care about who I am and even to respect my gender identity, because I'm very proud of who I am, both my gender identity and my identity of being a disabled person. And I'm very proud of that. And they're not going to change that, but it will always be harmful when they use the wrong pronouns or use quotations of, oh, they're non-binary, or they'll use she's non-binary in quotations, and then we'll go ahead and misgender me through the visit summary and their notes. So it definitely, when I read back on things, it hurts me very emotionally, because I've done so much to be who I am.
Yes. Oh my God, listen, you know, I'm crying for you. This is the outrage that this conjures for me is huge. And for you to be able to speak your truth and your experience in such a measured tone, Carter, is impressing me also, that this is not, you know, anyway, you're so articulate about this, and I compliment you on that. And anybody listening to this, I mean, listen to the tone of Carter's voice. Carter's telling the truth. This is the truth. This is the truth. And I am the one who, I guess, in this moment is expressing this in an emotional way. This is outrageous. This story is outrageous.
Hey, this is Emma. So yeah, I just wanted to say one thing though, like for your story, Carter, like 70 pounds. Wow. That's amazing. I wish I could do that. I'm just kidding.
I've had people, you know, come up to me because they knew that, and I knew I was losing weight, but I didn't realize how much weight I had lost until I ended up inpatient, because I couldn't weigh myself because I can't stand up. And so it wasn't until I was in the hospital and they weighed me and I was like, that's nuts. Like, why is no one doing anything? I had such severely low potassium. And if you have too low or too high of potassium, you can have a heart attack. You can have heart complications. And I was having my potassium replaced daily in the hospital. And they wouldn't do anything. And a very easy solution was to put in a feeding tube. And no one wants these medical devices because they suck. They're not comfortable. No one actively is like, you know what? I'm going to make myself throw up so severely that I could give myself a heart attack. And like actively like want that. No one wants to do that. And it's very frustrating when doctors will say, oh, well, we could still do this other thing. And it's like that other thing is not an option because of insurance. I was supposed to have a surgery before I lost all this weight to help my stomach move food through. So I was able to get nutrition, and insurance denied it because it was not under covered services, because they don't cover anything for gastroparesis, from procedures to medication. Now, because I have malnutrition and need a feeding tube, they are willing to give me a feeding tube because I'm now severely malnourished and have lost so much weight. And I've had people ask me, you know, are you happy about losing weight? Yeah, I'm happy that, you know, I am able to find clothes easier. but I'm not happy in the way that it happened, and I'm not happy in the way that it's affected my health.
Yeah, right, exactly. Because it's not, I mean, the reason that you lost so much weight is because of medical neglect, and that's not a way to lose weight. That's like asking someone who's a victim, you know, who's in a concentration camp, like, oh, are you happy you lost weight? That's a good thing, right?
That actually, since you bring that up, I was told in the hospital by a doctor that his other clients with gastroparesis look like Holocaust victims, and I don't. And quote said that to me and said that I did not need help.
Oh, God. Carter, I'm just so sorry for everything that's happened to you, but I'm glad that you're here to once again tell us the stories that you've experienced of medical neglect, because this is how we first met on Transpositive, was talking about all the ways in which you experienced that as someone who is disabled and, you know, in need of services, and who's also a transgender. And, you know, your story is just so heartbreaking. People need to hear it. And they need to change. There needs to be change in the system. And hopefully you've provided us with some education about the real life stories of people who are disabled, trans, queer, non-binary, and just plain old disabled, the kind of abuse that they suffer in the medical system in the United States. So thank you so much for sharing that.
Yeah, it's always hard to talk about it because you never want it to happen, but it's something that needs to be talked about, because this sadly is going on all over, and it happens to so many people, and no one is immune to becoming disabled. If
exactly.
you break your leg, you mm-hmm. are disabled.
Oh, yeah.
You are disabled in some way. If you break your pinky, you are now disabled in some way. And no one's ever immune to it. And the medical system needs to change, and as well as the way that society treats disabled people. Like I said, people see me crossing the street and they see me as a challenge because they don't want to wait for me.
I just want to observe that what I hear in Carter's narrative is a quadruple whammy, starting with a socioeconomic class, and then, you know, the trans identity and the disabilities, and then, you know, kind of the fourth point is the culmination of all three of the preceding layers in this system. And this system is so broken. And I think that this narrative, Carter, thank you for sharing, because I think it's very timely going into the midterm elections. And I hope that your narrative will be heard somewhere out there in the political system as, you know, an issue or a set of issues that needs to be addressed in this country. Whether we only get one or two of those layers addressed, you know, it's like it's going to be an improvement. But oh my goodness, when it comes to, you know, this fall, vote, you guys, everybody vote, because this is just, this is untenable. This is unlivable. Thank you.
I also wanted to say that a few months ago, I was at the dog park with my dog, and I had a seizure, and there was a paramedic who had responded, and she was the sweetest paramedic ever, and she had listened to a few of the shows that I've done, and it really opened her eyes to what I have experienced, instead of me just being in that moment and what she has seen and what other people have shared about me. So being able to share my story personally has already made an impact. And I know that there is change that will happen.
Thank you so much, Carter. We're going to take a little break now. And then when we come back, Nicolette's going to be talking to us about some trans issues in the news. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. All right, we're back, and so I'm gonna, Nicolette, you have some stuff that you've been looking at that's been going on in the news.
All right, yeah, so I think the first thing we need to talk about is the recent monkeypox outbreak, as the dialogue surrounding this outbreak is currently affecting the LGBT plus community and may affect trans people as well. Monkeypox is a virus spread through skin-to-skin contact that causes a rash, fever, headaches, body aches, chills, fatigue, and respiratory symptoms. The World Health Organization recently declared the recent spread of monkeypox a global health emergency. However, because a large number of the cases reported outside of Africa have been in gay and bi men, the World Health Organization has declared men who have sex with men to be at highest risk of infection right now, and have recommended reducing sexual partners to help prevent the spread of the disease. Since then, Republicans have been mocking the declaration of the global health emergency and claiming the virus is a, quote, gay disease, much like what happened with the AIDS epidemic. There have been Republican politicians such as Marjorie Taylor Greene who have falsely claimed the virus is a sexually transmitted disease and only affects certain populations, i.e. the LGBT population, when in fact it is spread through skin-to-skin contact. So that includes more than just having sex. And that means anyone can catch it if they touch someone who has the virus. And really, most likely the reason these gay and bi men caught it this time around is because LGBT plus people are often more comfortable touching each other, such as giving hugs. And that means cishet people could catch it just as easily if they touch an infected person. In fact, in the early 2000s, there was an outbreak of monkeypox in pet stores. So people, especially children, caught it from their pets. But now that this outbreak is affecting LGBT people, public have conveniently forgotten about when children caught it from pets and are claiming it's an STD only gay people can get. So now this virus is being branded as a gay disease, and not only are many people not taking it seriously, but this could lead to even more homophobia and possibly even transphobia as they use us as a scapegoat, like what happened with the AIDS epidemic. I read that a speaker at a rally in Manhattan who was a clinical director at Jewish Queer Youth is quoted as saying, a few months from now on the cover of every magazine, there will be children with monkeypox on their face and they will come after us. So I'm afraid of the consequences the dialogue surrounding this outbreak will have on the LGBT plus community. I wasn't even alive during the AIDS epidemic, but this sounds like everything I've heard about it. And now I'm afraid this is our generation's version of the same thing all over again.
Hmm. Yeah, it's pretty scary. I mean, it's everything that you said is just so scary, Nicolette. It's like, I think what's so disturbing of everything you said is how this disease, which doesn't have anything to do with sex, is being branded as a gay disease when it's something. I mean, for one thing, it's been around a long time, and like you said, it's spread through touch. So it's just I lived through HIV. I mean, I was around for HIV, and it was really bad. I mean, it was really, really bad, and people died alone and abandoned by their families, and everyone was in a panic, and there was hysteria, and people were trying to pass all kinds of laws, and there was so much stigmatizing going on, especially during the first 5 or 6 years of the disease. I mean, 5 or 6 years of this. It wasn't until ACT UP really got involved that I feel like once ACT UP started really doing like the actions that they did, they really changed the narrative. And I feel like that's when things really started to change.
Yeah, thank you. Anyone else want to comment before I move on?
Yeah, I did not know that was what people were saying. I had no idea that people were trying to say that it's a gay disease or an STD. Like that's just crazy to me. Especially because like it does just spread person to person. I'm also scared for the people who are immunocompromised, who could end up getting this as well. Because if, you know, there's people who are immunocompromised in the LGBTQ community, and they end up getting this, that they could get even sicker. So that's very scary to me.
Yeah. And I also have a comment. I also was around in the 80s and 90s. And if there's a bright point in all of this, I would say that we have, as a community, lived experience. If our community will listen to our lived experience, we're better prepared to deal with this than we were back then. So I don't know. I'm not saying it's a silver lining to a dark cloud, but at least we do have some lived experience in how this is probably all going to play out. We're better prepared. Thanks.
Maybe we should do a show about this.
I think that's a good idea, Emma.
Yeah. Okay. I'll do some research and find a couple of. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, if we're ready to move on, let's hop across the pond for news. In England, the Rugby Football Union and the Rugby Football League amended its regulations to permit only players assigned female at birth to compete in women's matches. So we're still dealing with transgender discrimination in sports. Anyone want to comment on that?
Oh my God, there's just been so many stories about this lately. I can't remember which. So in Florida, they're advising schools to not follow federal policy.
Yeah, I was about to get to that next, actually.
Oh, sorry. And okay. I mean, and there's a bunch of states now where they're basically saying that trans kids can't play in sports.
Well, I so I grew up in Banks, Oregon, and they are currently having this issue there, where they're having a lot of problems because the superintendent was resigning, and they were needing to find a new one, and they were needing to fill spots in the board, and a lot of the parents kept bringing up that they were allowing trans kids in sports. And growing up, I did not play sports, but I was in band and in choir, and we did go on trips, and I was allowed to go. I was allowed to stay in the room with the people that I felt comfortable with. So if I felt more comfortable staying with the quote girls versus quote boys, I could. Or if I felt more comfortable with the boys, I could do that. When I was a senior in high school, they did not want me in the locker rooms. So I did not have to take PE. They gave me an alternative to doing PE, which is just doing exercise at home and filling out forms and bringing that back to school. I also could not go to the bathroom in the building. I had to go to a building over, which was connected to the high school. But if I had a class on the opposite end of the school, like, it would take me 5 minutes to just get to the bathroom. And a lot of my teachers would get very upset because I also have a bladder condition and had to go to the bathroom multiple times in the class. So I was missing out on class because I couldn't go to the bathroom where I felt comfortable. Instead, I had to go to a different building.
Yeah, that's awful too. And we will talk more about that in the US, but first, in other news in England, the National Health Service in England announced on Thursday that it was shutting down the country's only youth gender clinic in favor of a more distributed and comprehensive network of medical care for adolescents seeking hormones and other gender treatments. The closure followed an external review of the Tavistock Clinic in London, which raised several concerns, including long wait times and insufficient mental health support. The NHS said current patients at the Tavistock Clinic could continue to receive care before transferring to two new hubs at children's hospitals in London and Manchester. The new clinics will expand the country's gender services while making sure children are adequately treated for autism, trauma, and mental health issues, and the specialists will carry out clinical research on gender medications. So that, I think, also ties back into what we were talking about, getting better health care, especially for gender-affirming care.
I make this observation, Nicolette.
Yeah?
As you read that, all kinds of at least yellow, if not red flags, started flying for me.
Yeah.
you know, the verbiage is one thing, the reality is something else altogether. And it sounds to me like a degradation of you know, trans pediatric healthcare in the UK. And here's what concerns me. The UK being a much smaller and less complex, I guess, in many ways, governmental system than our own, has been a harbinger of reactionary responses to the cultural shifts, acknowledging our existence and our rights, our human rights. This does not bode really well for the United States. And I keep coming back to, oh my God, if there's any answer I can offer or response that I can offer, it's like vote, 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 vote school board elections, vote every level that you can vote at, and get everybody else that you can get to vote, because this has been a multi-decades long specific tactical and strategic you know, attack on us, and we've been put in the spotlight, and you know, the only answer is, I mean, fight back to the extent that we can. That's it. I hate to, you know, make this a political action comment, but I don't know where else to address it.
Yeah, thank you, Jean. And yeah, we mentioned this earlier, but back in the U.S., Florida's Department of Education has advised schools to not follow federal guidelines that protect transgender youth. On Thursday, the Florida Department of Education sent a memo to education officials warning that they could face repercussions if they follow the Biden administration's newest Title IX guidelines, which were proposed in June and include protections from discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The memo warns against things like letting trans kids use facilities that align with their gender identity, and also suggests schools should not let trans kids play sports or stay in rooms on class trips with students that align with their gender identity.
You know, it just makes me wonder, like, so what sports could trans kids do? Bowling? Is that okay? Like, or do they have some sort of advantage in bowling?
Maybe what about
golf? Yeah. What about that one sport that they do in the Olympics nobody pays attention to, the one with the shuttlecock and the people scraping the ice?
What?
Maybe they'll let trans kids do that one. I don't know.
Hey, you know, Nicolette, Ron DeSantis is clearly positioning himself for a run for president in 2024. And it's like, oh my God, this is, you know, that wing of, you know, right-wing politics. We are going to continue to be a political football. We're going to continue to be a political tool or football.
Yeah.
You know, as we have been.
You know, speaking of football, there's no reason that any trans kid shouldn't be able to play football. So if there's a trans masculine or a gender non-binary or a gender fluid kid that wants to play football, let him play football. If there's a trans
girl, I love that, Emma. Yes.
Exactly. Wants to do gymnastics, let them do gymnastics. Just they're kids. Exactly. Just let them have
same
fun and do their sport. Exactly.
Same with disabled kids. Like, yeah. Disabled kids can also do these activities. And I have I'm in a group for parents. I'm in banks, and there are a lot of disabled kids that have been having problems in the school because they want to do these activities, and the school is like, well, we don't know how to help you do that. And it's like, well, this is how. Now do it.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Carter, that is such a you know, pointed, right on point comment. This has been our history, hun. It's been our history. It's been our history in healthcare. It's been our history in every aspect of how we have maybe clawed our way tentatively to, you know, the point where we are here in 2022. But we've had to educate everybody, healthcare people, political people, our neighbors, I mean, our families, everyone. We have it's such a burden. It's such a burden on top of everything else that we have to deal with, to have to be the educators and problem solvers. And it causes so much consternation, so much debate within our own community. This is the way it has always been. I'm not to say that it should always be like this, but this is, we've made progress, but the battle continues. I guess that's my point.
So we've got about 5 minutes left. So
should we end on some good news? I've got one more little bit.
That'd be great.
Okay. So where was I? In the midst of all this anti-trans legislation around the country, we finally have two pro-trans bills introduced in California recently. SB 923 will require physicians and health insurance providers to receive training on how to deal with transgender and non-binary people, as well as require insurance companies to include a list of providers that provide hormone replacement therapy or perform gender-confirming surgeries in their network directories. And SB 107 would prohibit state agents from complying with other state subpoenas for medical information and would prevent non-California courts from demanding the state remove children from homes where gender treatments are occurring.
That is really good news. It's nice to hear some good news.
Yeah. That's amazing. I have a friend who is a paramedic, and he actually went to a conference and teaches other emergency professionals about how to care for trans people. And for this to be a bill, like, this is amazing. This is absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I'm glad at least in some cases, in some places, we are making the right steps forward.
Well, thank you. You've been listening to Trans Positive tonight. Does anybody have any closing comments or things that they'd like to share before we end the show?
I'm going to echo what Jean has been saying. Get out there and vote. Because that's the only, one of the only ways anyway, that we can make any feasible difference in the government and how our rights are being regulated.
You've been listening to Trans Positive tonight here on KBOO Community Radio. My name is Emma. I use she and her pronouns. Thank you so much for joining us. And let's go around and have everybody say good night.
Oh, I'm Nicolette, and I use AM or they, them pronouns. Thank you for listening to Trans Positive. Good night.
Jeans, she, her. Stay cool out there if you can.
Carter, they, them. I hope you guys all have an amazing night.
transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks,
McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the US.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors,
your coworkers,
your students,
your customers,
and even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 And we need your support.